It's the local thread, and this is the Anderson Hour. I'm Jerry Anderson. You know, it was 2 years ago that WGTE Public Media kicked off one of the most ambitious journalistic efforts I've ever been a part of in a long broadcast career. Our Rethinking Jails and Justice town hall, streamed live, gave rise to a series of outstanding podcasts hosted by Jason Hibbs and several long-form radio interviews which I conducted. So a question, what are we doing about someone incarcerated who just didn't do it? Today, that's in our Anderson Hour. Jails have become warehouses for people who are poor, lack housing, or suffer from mental illness or addiction. They starkly reflect America's long history of racism. Those words are strong, and those are the words of the National Safety and Justice Challenge. It's a challenge that has been accepted by several locations around the country, including right here in Lucas County. I welcome you to Rethinking Jails and Justice, a series of forums produced by WGTE Public Media in cooperation with Lucas County and the local Safety and Justice Challenge participants. Now, we met several of them when we streamed a live town hall meeting back in January. 12 panelists fielded questions regarding criminal justice reform. Many of those questions came from you, the audience, both those in attendance at the main library in downtown Toledo and from those watching online. Now that evening, we made a promise to continue answering questions, starting with those which time limitations prevented us from answering that night. So today, we begin what is planned to be a series of monthly interviews seeking still more answers. My name is Jerry Anderson. I was honored to moderate the Rethinking Jails and Justice Town Hall and to now host this program today. A couple of extremely important questions if we are to bring about true criminal justice reform. Again, your questions. They include, what about innocent people in prisons? What's being done to free them? Also, how are we helping those who've been in prison, who've done their time, re-enter a society which often marks them with the stigma of ex-con? Now, these are folks who, you know, they're marched to the gates of the prison. They're told you're free to go, but go to what? If they have no home, job, money, transportation, driver's license, social security card, are they not destined to repeat the behavior that saw them lose their freedom in the first place? So joining us on our program today, I want to welcome in Professor Mark Godsey from the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Professor Godsey also leads the Ohio Innocence Project, which seeks to use hard evidence, often scientific evidence, think DNA, to free those wrongly convicted. Also with us in studio, the charge was murder. The verdict was guilty. The problem is, he didn't do it. After years of incarceration, a judge would agree. The same judge who put Willie Knighton Jr. behind bars. Mr. Knighton in studio now uses his experience to help others navigate the criminal justice system, to re-enter society, or possibly avoid the behaviors in the first place for which the system incarcerates people. Karen McConnell is with us in studio, knows the law well, earned a law degree. She also knows well that people who run afoul of the law face often monumental challenges in getting their lives together. But she's taken up those challenges by heading what is called the Reentry Coalition of Northwest Ohio. Who makes up that coalition? What do they do? Are they making a difference? We're going to find out this hour. So welcome in. Here we go. As I begin, I need to point out that the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Safety and Justice Challenge emphasizes reimagining and reforming the local criminal justice system, including reducing the local jail population, reducing inequities, including racial inequities, in the local criminal justice system. Our town hall pointed out that these local jails have about 19 times the admissions per year of state and federal prisons and penitentiaries. But our town hall discussion gave rise to the aforementioned questions to which we promised answers. We're getting those right now. Professor Godsey, seems to me if they're innocent by the time your organization connects with them in prison, they were innocent back in their local jail awaiting trial or post-trial relocation to serve their sentence. Do we have a credible estimate of how many inmates, what percentage of our prison population is innocent of the charges against them? I mean, they just didn't do it.
Well, it's very difficult to arrive at that number and that percentage. There's scholars who have tried to do it, and they've suggested 4 or 5% of everybody who's in prison is completely innocent. To me, that might be a little high, but you know, even if it's 1%, that would be tens of thousands of people across the United States. So it's a significant problem, even if it's 1%. I think it's probably higher than that.
I had read 2 to 10%. 10% to me would be striking, but I agree with you, 2% is not acceptable because, again, folks, please follow me. We're talking about people who didn't do the crime for which they are doing time. Professor.
Yeah, again, you know, 2%, that's a heck of a lot when you extrapolate across the state of Ohio and the U.S. You know, we look into these cases years later, and we've freed now 42 people in Ohio prisons who were innocent. They served together over 900 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. But, I mean, we know that's just the tip of the iceberg, because most of the cases, when people write to us and say, I'm innocent, you know, please help me reinvestigate my case, we look into it, and, you know, the DNA evidence has been destroyed, the witnesses are dead. You know, there's nothing we can really do, and you have to be pretty lucky. If you look at the 42, every one of them had, you know, sort of miracle after miracle, where this person survived, and now they can come and testify later, and this DNA, we found it in the court reporter's basement of her house, and you know, just luck after luck after luck, and you have to have those things line up for you, the stars align, so to speak, in order to prove your innocence years later.
I asked that same question of an attorney one time. Now, this was a prosecutorial type of attorney. I said, how many prison inmates are actually innocent? And he replied, all of them. I'm like, what? He goes, just ask them. Okay, I see where you're, I guess that's some prosecutorial humor. We know the majority did commit some offense for which they are doing time. So how does the Ohio Innocence Project determine which cases to pursue?
Yeah, it's a complicated process. So, you know, we start looking into the case. First of all, they have to say, I'm innocent. I didn't do it. I wasn't there. Sometimes people will write us and they'll say, hey, I got convicted of being the trigger man, but I was just the getaway driver. You know, well, that maybe you were prosecuted for the wrong role, but you still did it. You're not innocent.
Right.
We don't take cases like that. So, you know, I would say if you look at, we've been doing this for over 20 years now. If you look at the make it into a pie chart, the biggest slice is people that once we start looking into the case, it's pretty obvious they're guilty and they did it. And the next biggest slice is, you know, the evidence has been destroyed. We just can't really look into the case. But, you know, I guess we start looking into the things they're claiming. We start, you know, interviewing witnesses. We see if the DNA exists. And after a certain amount of time, it's some of the cases is just like, well, every time we turn a new corner, something else stinks in the case. And after that keeps happening after a while, you go, boy, this person really might have been railroaded. Or on the other hand, every time you look into something, it's clear that the person committed the crime, and you keep opening more doors, and it says guilty, 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 and we end up just cutting that case. So it's a process of just reinvestigation.
I'm sitting on information now. This isn't necessarily connected with the Innocence Project nationally or in Ohio. There's something called the National Registry of Exonerations, which says that 575 people have been exonerated based on DNA testing in the U.S. It's a big number. But then the one that, when I saw it, made me sit back, and it did, Willie and Karen in studio, it kind of took my breath away. 35 people who were sitting on death row. We, as a society, in the name of justice, were going to take somebody's life from them, and they didn't do the crime. That's almost breathtaking. That makes us as a society as guilty as anybody. We run through the court system, doesn't it?
Right. Well, and that's just DNA. There have been a lot of people exonerated from death row with non-DNA evidence.
Yeah.
So the number is actually a lot higher. Yeah, it's scary. And, you know, we've got innocent people on death row here in Ohio.
Mark Godsey, our guest, what is the Innocence Project's relationship with, and I can't wait for this answer, relationship with prosecutors? I mean, if we're truly after justice, shouldn't this be a cooperative process? Is it?
Unfortunately, not always. I mean, so recently in Summit County, we've had some cooperation, and there's a really good guy running what's called the Conviction Integrity Unit up there, where they cooperate with us and look into cases. And J.D. Tomlinson, who's in a suburb of Cleveland, Lorain County, he's a prosecutor that's been very cooperative and just trying to do the right thing. But people would be surprised how often, you know, politicians are, I mean, prosecutors are elected. They're politicians. They don't want to admit mistakes were made. Same with judges. We have elected judges here in Ohio. And so a lot of times people just are closed-minded about it. They don't want to cooperate. They don't want to admit they made a mistake. They don't want anybody looking at their work 15, 20 years later. You know, a lot of these times we're looking into the case, and the prosecutor has had that conviction, the newspaper headline, framed in their office for the past 20 years. That's their trophy. And then somebody's coming in and saying, we want to do DNA testing. We want to see if this guy's innocent or not. They take that personally. And, you know, it shouldn't be that way. You know, and so in a lot of counties, that's the way it is. But it just sort of depends on the personality. But far too often, they're resistant and they don't want anybody, like, you know, looking into their work or double-checking it.
There seem to me, I'm going to play devil's advocate here a bit, there seem to be so many safeguards in the system to protect the accused. I mean, first of all, the gathering of evidence. And there has to be enough evidence for a grand jury to say, yeah, we should probably pursue this. They return an indictment. Then in a trial, the prosecutor is just having it his or her way and convinces 10 or 11 jury members out of 12. Guess what? The prosecutor still loses. Guilty verdicts are then, of course, appealed. How is it with all of those protections built in, Mark Godsey, that we end up with probably thousands nationwide of innocent people behind bars? What is wrong in the criminal justice system that is yielding that outcome?
Well, it's not the procedures. It's human frailty. So every one of the causes of wrongful convictions have to do with human weaknesses. So, you know, you have an eyewitness. You know, so the leading cause is eyewitness misidentification. Somebody's positive that they've picked out the right person. They're not a bad person. They're doing the best they can. They're not lying. But they're just wrong. And so, you know, the biggest cause of wrongful conviction is witness misidentification. It doesn't matter what the procedures are. If somebody comes in and says, that's the guy who did it, I'm 100% positive, and later DNA testing proves that they're innocent, you know, it doesn't matter what procedures you have. People are going to believe an eyewitness who stands up and says, that's the guy who did it, and I'm sure. And the thing is, the DNA testing is continually advancing. So, you know, we have crimes occurring today that there's not enough DNA left at the scene, so we can't really get an answer from DNA. But, you know, in 15 years, it'll continue to advance to the point where we can. So technology is constantly advancing. But, you know, humans are going to make the same kind of errors regardless of whether it's now, 20 years ago, or in the future. You know, another big problem is, and, you know, these are things that we can work on and correct to some degree. You know, we have all these shows like CSI that paint forensics like some, you know, miracle, like putting man on the moon. But a lot of them are really flawed. You know, I could talk for 2 hours about that, but you know, jurors will hear somebody come in on a white lab coat and talk about this mystical forensic science, and they've determined that the footprint found next to the body matches the defendant's shoe. And, you know, there's a lot of flaws with that. There's things we could do to clean that up. You know, defense lawyering, you know, we got a lot of defense attorneys who aren't doing their job. I mean, understandably, they're underpaid and underappreciated and everything else, but the system is not a level playing field. I've seen just egregious cases of defense attorneys not doing their job. And then, you know, prosecutors are human beings. They want to win. They get tunnel vision. Same with the detectives. We all suffer from tunnel vision. We all suffer from confirmation bias. They get a hunch and think they're right, and then they try to fit a square peg into a round hole and just go, you know, not remaining as objective and neutral as they should until all the facts are in. So these are just human errors that have more to do with the fact that the criminal justice system is still operating under theories of psychology from the 1950s at best, rather than, you know, current science and current understanding of the human mind and how it works.
Mark Godsey joining us from Cincinnati. Let's get this now into our studio here. This will transition nicely because sitting to my two persons to my left is Willie Knighton Jr. And I can tell you, Professor Godsey, he has been nodding what appears to be total understanding of what you're talking about because he's lived it. Willie Knighton.
Yep, and Willie knows this.
Yeah. Yours is not a story. I want to make sure, Willie Knighton. This is not a story of a broken home life. Oh, this is a guy, he was raised by crack addicts and gangbangers on the streets. No, mom and dad were together, gainfully employed. He's still are, thank you. He with the post office, she with a food processing production company. I mean, you went to a private Christian elementary school, but you got sideways with authorities. Why? How?
It was fun.
It was fun.
Yes, it was fun.
It's what kids at that age did.
Right. hanging with new friends, trying new things, experimenting. It led me down a wrong path that I always knew was wrong, but I did it anyway. And before I knew it, I was in the system, in the juvenile justice system. I turned 18 in Cuyahoga Hills School for Boys. And then when I was released, I told myself I was going to do right. I started working, but I was still doing things in the streets. And came to the attention of the police and the mayor at that time. And we had words, and before you know it,
I don't think you'd be talking about former Mayor Cardi Finkbinder, would you?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And so I came to the top of their most wanted list. They started the SED unit, which is a gang task force, and one day I was arrested.
Okay. I'm going to get you back to that point, but I'm going to back up a little bit here, because in a way, a hero in my mind emerged, because I know you talk to a lot of parents these days.
Yes, I do.
Go back to, you got kicked out of Toledo Public Schools. When the word got to your father, his approach was what?
He asked me, was I there? I said, yes, sir. He said, my son's guilty.
I didn't know they could do that. The fact is, you were there, but you were not
in it at all, but I was there. And so in his eyes, I was guilty by association.
Wow.
Yeah, accountability.
Which I can tell you, in covering in the news business for as long as I did, how many times a young person gets in trouble and then their parents come in and say, it's not my kid didn't do it. It's you. And they're going to blame the authorities. That was not the case for you.
Not
your
at
dad
all.
Said if he was even there, boom, guilty. Mm-hmm. Deal with him. You will admit to doing a lot of wrong things, bad things, but not getting caught.
Right.
Okay. I think a lot of people listening to this can identify that we do some things, we don't get caught. You did go to prison twice, and you tell me that in both of those cases, you didn't do the crime.
Did not.
And I can hear the audience out there saying, yeah, right. Kind of a tough sell, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's the truth, so I don't have to sell it.
Then how did you get convicted?
Eyewitness testimony.
You heard Mark Gossie just talk yes. about eyewitness testimony. We want to believe that, oh, she says he did it, she saw him, was there, game, set, match, close it. Attorneys, Mark Gossie still on our line, will tell me that eyewitness identification is it some of the weakest evidence that out there?
Eyewitness testimony is very unreliable, we now realize. And it's, you know, like I said, the leading cause of wrongful conviction.
Doesn't that seem to boggle your mind? Like, I know what I saw, and I know what I didn't saw, and I saw you do it, and it's actually, then it's proven that, no, actually, you didn't see them. At least not that person. How'd you get convicted? Yours was not a jury trial, was it?
No, really? I went with a bench trial. My attorney said...
Explain that.
The bench trial is, if you're up for just a murder charge, one judge would hear the case. He would then be jury and fact finder. If it's a capital murder, it's three judges that would hear the case. My attorney, he knew I was innocent, and he said that the prosecutor was very, by the book, very sharp, and that he could trick a jury. He said the judge was also very smart and would see through the lies and would go with the truth and I'd be found not guilty. That wasn't the case.
This was a decision, though, that you guys got to make.
Yes.
Okay. You chose that thinking a jury could be swayed.
Mm-hmm.
This judge, too sharp, the prosecutor, too straightforward to be swayed. That blew up on you. How?
I was found guilty on all charges. Attempted murder, and two gun specification.
Sentenced to?
18 years to life.
Well, and I hope to never find out what it would feel like to be wrongly incarcerated. I can only imagine what I would be feeling when I think about it. I'm guessing anger, maybe to the point of rage, hatred, hopelessness. You say you didn't go there, however. Where did you go in mind and spirit when you are both A, wrongly accused, and then wrongly convicted?
I went to my roots. Being the child of a minister, watching my dad, his faith, losing his job after 13 years. He never let up. I would walk in the house from school and he'd be on his knees praying. He wouldn't stop praying. I'd just walk around him. He would get a job, he'd continue to pray. Get another job, continue to pray. And he never gave up. So when that happened, I called home, he said, pick up the Bible, you know where to go. And that's what I did. And 27 years later, I haven't put it down.
In your way of thinking, this was part of God's plan for you.
It was, definitely.
To be incarcerated, let me get this, 13 years, 11 months, something like that?
11 days short of 13 years.
13 years, okay. Do you ever go before the parole board?
No. I would have still been in prison if I had to, because I wouldn't have not lied and said I did this. I would have died in prison. I accepted it.
Tell me about someone named Jose Torres.
Jose Torres, wow, a miracle. It was 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with COVID, and it was just before I went to the hospital. They had to admit me for 5 days. He had called and he said, "Mr. Knighton, you don't know me, but I know you, and let me tell you how." He said, "I was an attorney for the Ohio Parole Board, and I was at work one day, and I was curious as to why the stack of petitions for the governor did not meet the criteria. And there was a stack that did." He said, "I reached into the one on my left and I picked one out. It was yours."
And he said, That did not meet criteria for being paroled.
Right.
Okay.
Did not meet the criteria to even be seen by the parole board.
Okay.
And he said, "I became intrigued." He said, "It just made sense that if there's some truth to this, I need to do something." And so he reached out to the judge, Judge Scow.
Judge William Scow, William Scow.
Mm-hmm. And they had spoke, and the judge had told him that this case had weighed so heavily on his heart and mind for the last 12 and a half years.
He had rendered the guilty verdict, and yet that verdict hung over him for years.
Yes. And as they spoke, just before he hung up, Mr. Torres said that he asked the judge, "Would you be willing to put in writing what we just discussed?" And the judge faxed over that letter, which eventually led to my freedom. And he passed away 2 months after he wrote the letter.
Or you would still be sitting behind bars.
Yes.
Did you have experience or contact with, you heard us talking to Mark Godsey, have you had any contact with the Ohio Innocence Project during that process?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about it.
I had reached out to the Ohio Innocence Project, and at the time they had a lot of cases with DNA. But they had still had mine somewhat on the back burner. So when Judge Scott reached out to them to put the petition together, they jumped on it. And they submitted it. I didn't even know. And before I know it, I received a call on the 23rd of November, 2009. And it was Governor Ted Strickland. He said, "Hey, free Willie Knighton in the morning." And I had just went to the store, prison store. I just spent $50. I'm like, "What am I going to do with all this food?"
Yeah, could I stay in for a week? Did you say? Yeah, I don't think so. Mark Godsey, do you remember the case?
Yeah, it was a case that the attorney in our office, Carla Hall, worked on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't typically get involved with clemency, but this was a situation where we had the judge who rendered the guilty verdict reaching out and saying, "I think I made an error." It doesn't really give avenues for new trial to go back in into the traditional litigation like a DNA test result, but we thought it was a good case to potentially take to the parole board and try to get clemency or a pardon. But you know, to be honest with you, Willie Knighton sort of made his own case, and getting out on clemency and then doing all the wonderful things that he did in the community, I think, you know, demonstrated his innocence and ultimately led to his complete pardon.
I want to pick up on that though, because Willie, You refer to yourself as an exonerated former prisoner.
Yes.
You've not been found innocent.
Correct.
And last I checked in our society, and I don't have the law degree, but you're presumed innocent, I believe, until proven guilty. You are in the process now, tell our listeners about that, of basically trying to prove with the prosecutor's office, explain that, your innocence.
I am going to prove it by the grace of God. A few weeks ago, I met with the prosecutor here, lead prosecutor, Julia Bates.
Yeah.
And we spoke, and she had just agreed to grant an integrity unit here in Lucas County, which is a great start. And then she asked about my case. And she explained to it how she had came into her position in 1997. So she was very new in her position. And she said, "Mr. Knight, if you are indeed innocent, how do we prove it?"
And what did she call this that she has established?
Integrity unit.
To do what?
to look over wrongful convictions. It's like the one that Mark was just talking about in Summit County.
Okay.
And so she asked me, she said, do you know anybody at the Ohio Innocence Project? I said, well, yes, I do. I know a few of them. And after I leave your office, I'm on my way to Cincinnati to meet with them.
Okay. So. Mark Gonzi, we were talking about Willie never went before a parole board. Tell me about your cases that you've dealt with through the Ohio Innocence Project. When you guys are able to come up with DNA evidence, is that the avenue to getting that person out of prison, make your case before a parole board, or do you go back to the sentencing judge? Tell me about that.
Yeah, when you develop new evidence of innocence, and it's not always DNA, obviously that's the gold standard, but we go back to the original trial court that did the conviction and sentencing, and you file what's called a motion for new trial based on new evidence of innocence. So you have to litigate there. That's the most frequent path of exoneration.
All right, Mark Gonzi, stay with us. Willie Knighton's in studio. Karen McConnell, thank you for your patience.
No problem.
There's a reason. Just file it under saving the best till last, if that,
we'll
helps out.
That.
No, there's a method to my madness here, because I thank you for your patience, but if Mark Gonzi can help free an innocent man, or if an inmate does complete his sentence and is released, it usually isn't floating balloons and candles and cakes and celebrations around, is it? What do people coming out of prison, what are their challenges?
People coming home face many barriers. The most often we see people dealing with is transportation, employment, and housing. Those are three basic pillars that we all take for granted. We know we can go outside and jump in our car after we're leaving our job, and we're pretty much headed to our house. That's not testimony for individuals that are returning. They're struggling to find somewhere to live. That struggle could be maybe in the past, maybe they had a lot of evictions on their record. Maybe they just don't have income to even pay arrearages or to pay a current rent, credit to get a mortgage or to pass a credit check to get an apartment. If they're trying to live with family members, maybe they've burned some bridges wherein they can't go back to that home. Maybe that home doesn't exist. Maybe the family fell on hard times while they were incarcerated, trying to help them out. Myriad of issues that can come into play where it comes to housing.
When we think of families being there, and we've seen some of those images too, and wrapping their arms around somebody either exonerated, i.e. Willie Knighton, we see some of those stories nationally, or somebody who has just done their time.
Correct.
That they've paid their debt. You say, but in some cases, families
just not the case.
Are just not welcoming. Why?
Well, you have to understand, a lot of people that are incarcerated are coming from a situation of mental health. Maybe there is an addiction issue. Maybe they do have a background that was not that of Willie Knighton's that we just talked about. Mm. So if you're going back to a dysfunctional situation, how do you go from dysfunction to dysfunction? How do you make life work in that scenario? So they just don't, maybe they don't have the support system that they automatically need. And that's where the coalition can come in to some extent and wrap our arms around them and provide a support system that they might not even know they needed, and now they do have one.
I want to get us there because it is an amazing story. I got to cover it years ago when I was doing television news, got my eyes opened in terms of how much need there is.
Lenore
for
opened
that.
Your eyes, I'm sure.
Do you think?
I know.
Talking about Lenore Barry.
Yes.
She'll get you. You sit with an interview. I ask a question. I just pretty much sat back. And we were done.
It's a dissertation.
Let's go to this. It's called, what, recidivism, isn't it? Returning to the same behavior that got you in trouble in the first place.
Yes.
So do people think, when they get caught again, do they think, okay, I know what I did wrong last time. I won't get caught this time. Or is it desperation? I mean, I got to eat. I got to have a place to sleep. I got to get some money. What is it?
I think it's a combination of the two. We call the first invincibility fable. You think that you're just...
Invincibility fable.
You're
okay.
Not going to get caught. You're going to somehow get by. You're slicker than you think you are, and you're not. So that's the first scenario. And then people are desperate. If they come home and they can't adjust, they can't live in a life that doesn't have the same boundaries and the same restrictions that they were used to having, if they've grown accustomed to that or codependent upon that, and they just can't function, then they may recidivate because the life that they knew before is easier than the life that they have now.
Mark Gonzi, when the people you've dealt with through the Ohio Innocence Project, when you do get them freed, what does your organization do, or do you just hand off? What does your organization do to make sure that these people have a path back to and into society?
when Willie Knighton got out back in the earlier days, we didn't have any sort of resources available. But through time, we now have an infrastructure where we have, fortunately, a donor who has given some funds to help us, you know, get people an apartment, clothing, in some cases, you know, education, tuition, or a used car to help them get back on their feet. Often if you're wrongfully convicted and serve prison time for something you didn't do, you have PTSD when you come out. So we've got a therapist who does group and individual sessions. So we do have sort of a robust aftercare system now, but that's actually kind of unusual. Most Innocence Projects around the country don't have that. You know, we've just had been fortunate to have donors that stepped up in that respect. But I mean, you know, you need help. I mean, it's a particular kind of mental trauma to go to prison for something you didn't do. And, you know, all these guys have trust issues after that. They don't trust anybody often. And so getting them turned back around and living a productive life, you know, it takes a lot. It takes a lot.
Years ago, I got to cover, back in studio here with Karen McConnell, got to cover, to me, an eye-opening event called First Wednesday. It still exists, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Tell me about it.
So First Wednesdays, also called Going Home to Stay, occurs every first Wednesday, hence the name, at One Government Center from 11 to 1. And really is a takeover of the whole first floor. We take over the commissioner's chambers, city council chambers, and it's a resource, a reentry resource fair, if you will, for returning citizens. So that can be anyone who's been involved with criminal justice from one day being released to being released 20 years ago. We don't care what the time frame is. If you need assistance, you're able to come. So what happens is there's a collaboration of reentry-minded individuals and agencies who will present to people in the audience. About 200 people come. And when I say people, I'm talking about returning citizens, participants, who will come and hear this information.
200 on the first Wednesday.
Correct.
Or every month?
Yes.
Are they sometimes the same people?
Sometimes they are repeat if they need additional assistance, or they may bring a friend. You just never know. But
so
yes.
Over the course of the year, it's a big number.
It's a huge
number. Not that 200 is small in any month, but over the course of a year, that's a big number. Okay,
yes.
Continue.
So that's the first hour, 11 to 12, and then there's a breakout session where they go into a big conference room, and it's set up like a job fair. So there are tables where the agencies are able to share their resources and speak with individuals about their specific case. So if you have a child support case, you can talk to child support about your individual case. One of the big hitters, I would say, is BMV, who's able to talk to individuals about what they need to get their license reinstated. So they can run their points, they can tell them what their fees are, help them set up a payment plan. That's probably the biggest draw that we do have at First Wednesdays.
Willie Knighton, some folks come out of prison and they're still facing fines that were levied on them way back when.
Right.
This effort, First Wednesday, alternately called?
Going Home to Stay.
Going Home to Stay addresses that how? Isn't there a judge involved there? Is it Judge Kuhlman?
Yes, Judge Timothy Kuhlman, the municipal court. If they qualify, which most of them do, with having fines and court costs in municipal court in Toledo, we can put them on a reentry docket. So it's the third Thursday of every month at 1:30 p.m. And then we have spread it so much that now the other principalities, we have Maumee. They now help the clients. We have Perrysburg. We have Oregon and Sylvania. We've made relationships with them. So I can go out to Judge Bonfiglio and say, I have a gentleman here, Your Honor, just came home, and this is what he's doing here. And we're trying to see if we can get assistance with the fine. So sure, the payment plan will sometimes be lowered where you can make the payment. And they say, hey, if you are late 1 month, just contact us. We'll work with you as long as you contact us first. So there's no excuses for anyone coming out of incarceration when they come back to Lucas County. They can make it.
Does the system, when it releases somebody from our prison system, does it tell them you must do this, or is this all just voluntary on the part of the former inmate?
So on the probation side, it's absolutely voluntary, but it's strongly encouraged. On the parole side, I believe Chris makes it part of their condition that they would have to come to First Wednesday. Chris Stewart is the representative for a parole authority in Northwest Ohio.
Okay.
One of ours. She works very closely with us. She strongly encourages, and then we'll do the follow-up, and then we'll check and see if they're there, and then we'll make sure that they're connected to the right people. So they're very hands-on in getting them connected with the Reentry Coalition.
Let's go back to recidivism, because the whole safety and justice challenge locally, which again, folks, is charged with reimagining and rebuilding local criminal justice systems in reducing jail incarceration and increasing equity for all, also reducing inequality, racial inequality in our jail population. And I'm still going to get there on this program, folks, so stay with me. That's an important piece as well. I want to do this to all of my guests, Mark Gonti down in Cincinnati, Willie Knighton, Karen McConnell here in the studio. During our January town hall, we learned that the local effort toward criminal justice reform was showing impressive results on several fronts. The local prison population is down, something like 40%, I believe is the case. Police now are being trained to de-escalate situations that could become overheated. A lot of these things are just the police are called and then a word is said, a name is called, a punch is thrown, and I'm gonna tell you, somebody's going to jail that night if a punch is thrown. So, they're being trained to de-escalate situations that could become overheated. Local inmates in the local jail undergo a risk assessment to assist a judge in making a determination. Can we release this person safely? There is now coordination between several probation entities around Lucas County because so many of these people came out and they had to report to three or four of them at the same time. A lot of things, the diversion idea, and Mark Gonti might want to weigh in on this one. Folks, diversion, I remember covering this in the television news business, historically has been a method for some of the accused to take some training, get some education on why what they did is wrong, and thereby avoid further or any criminal prosecution. That is a program, diversion, which is, I'm sorry if this steps on toes, historically has been used a lot more for white folk, especially white folk of some stature, an executive here, a leader there, than people of color. That now is being more widely applied to minorities in our county. Can you talk, Willie Knighton? I just clicked off several things that the Safety and Justice Challenge folks are ticking off as successes locally. Can you speak to those?
Yes. It's been great working with MacArthur. So I was one of the recipients. I became a mentor through CTF, which is the Correctional Treatment Facility. ATI, I first heard it during the MacArthur meeting. It's alternative to incarceration. Mm. So now we offer treatment. So I go in CTF 5 days a week, and I'm allowed to meet with those who have had the risk assessment, talk with their case managers. If there's anything in their past that speaks or addiction or substance use disorder or mental health, I go in our mentor. I mentor from lived experience, and I also mentor from having a CDCA in addiction. And I'm allowed to walk them through why they're there, why we have their attention, and give all the tools and resources so when they get out, it's a warm handoff. And sometimes it's my left hand to my right hand. Yeah. Sometimes it's me to a coworker like Charles King, who was my cellmate, who did 13 years in prison, who now has a bachelor's degree and works with me. And so there's a lot that's going on with it. The jail population, it's the city of Toledo has come together. We knocked down all the silos, and it's community buy-in. That's what makes it so successful, community buy-in.
When I was talking about the First Wednesday program, I wanted to get to Karen also, go back to this recidivism thing. When people come through your program successfully, does it have an impact on the rate of recidivism? Because in the overall Safety and Justice Challenge, they would say we're doing all of these things that Willie has enumerated and I did, and we're doing it without an increase in crime. We're doing it without an increase in recidivism. Are we seeing that impact also as a result of the reentry program?
So I don't want to definitively misspeak and say there's a direct correlation.
Okay.
However, comma, the numbers have come down. And I will say that we have definitely played a hand in that number coming down. So Lucas County, we're hovering around 25% recidivism rate. whereas the state is about 31%, and nationally it's about 50. So that we've remained under that radar, we remain lower than the national and the state level for years and years. I do believe that is a direct relation to the work of the Reentry Coalition.
Mark Gonsi, you're joining us still, and I want to get you on your way. You've been very generous with your time. He's a professor of law, University of Cincinnati. He leads the Ohio Innocence Project. They have seen the release of many people in this state. Nationally, I thought of the Innocence Project just this week because I knew Mark was going to be on. When I first heard Innocence Project, you know what name came to mind? Barry Scheck. Does that name to anybody? And I guess I'm giving away my age because Barry Scheck first came into my knowledge back at a time that we also thought of just recently in the last week or so, the passing of O.J. Simpson. He was part of that entire effort out there. Can you tell us, Mark Gonsi, the people that are freed through the Ohio Innocence Project, you can't even ask about recidivism because that goes back to and repeating the same crime. These folks didn't commit the crime in the first place, right?
Yeah, very few of the individuals that we've gotten out have committed any sort of crime. We've had some who've had more minor things, and you know, I can think of a DUI, things of that nature, but not anything major. So, yeah, it's a different category because it's people that didn't do the crime to begin with.
One of the things we did discover during our town hall, that with all of these areas in which we can say, if not check the box, we can say we're going the right direction, we're achieving certain things, it was pointed out from members of the panel that we still haven't seen success in reducing racial inequities in the local criminal justice system. Is that your experience where you are, Mark Gonsi, and what steps do we need to take to address that? The race issue is tough, but I said we're going to do tough stuff on this program. Where do we go with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely still a problem. I mean, we're you know, I think education, but there's more we can do in the system in terms of jury instructions, allowing us to more openly confront those issues during, you know, jury selection, and things of that nature. But I mean, this is a human problem. It's a societal problem. It's not just the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system is going to reflect problems we have in our society. And so, you know, it's something we all have to work on. But I think there are concrete things we can do to try to improve it. But absolutely, I see it. I can give numerous examples.
Willie Knighton, you've lived through this. Would you have been convicted if you were a white man?
I don't know. I have to be honest and say I don't know.
It's a fair question.
Yeah, it's a fair question. I honestly don't know. Because it wasn't the, well, it was an overzealous detective for sure. I wouldn't say anything bad about the prosecution. And it was witnesses that lied. So, possibility. I know sometimes I was arrested.
You believe they were coached?
They were absolutely coached. Absolutely 110% coached.
Told what to say and how to say it to be convincing.
Absolutely.
Mom would suggest to you that race in a case like that could have made a huge difference. Karen, I want you to weigh in as well on the whole racial inequity thing. We actually, Willie was there at the town hall. This was down at the main library downtown. Mm-hmm. Somebody, whether they came through the internet watching on the stream, or somebody said, first of all, I think in the first sentence was, okay, here's a bunch of liberals, okay, referring to everybody involved in Safety and Justice Challenge, and say, well, I guess white people just need to go out and
commit more crimes
so that they can have a larger percentage of the population. Is looking at our prison population by race and drawing a parallel to the makeup of Toledo's population by race, is that flawed from the get-go?
I think it is flawed. And I'll say, I was going to go back to something Mark said.
Please.
Mark said that we, there's ways that we can kind of fix this from the inside. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at who's the judge and jury, so the judge, we don't have a lot of African-American judges or judges of color. So if you have someone trying a case to the bench, typically you're trying the case to someone of the majority. So that right there can lend to some inequalities. Love all of our judges, but I'm just saying as an example. also your juries that you pick, your jury pool. Your jury pool is based upon your voters. If you don't register people of color to vote, or if you put barriers in place for them to vote, they can't sit on your jury. So if they're the juries that is deciding your fate, how in the world are you going to get a fair shake for someone who's going to practice racial equity in that instance? Doesn't make sense.
That, I'm sitting here like saying that is exactly right, and it's on my mind because I live in Wood County. And guess what? I just got the card in the mail that I'm a prospective juror. Please,
I'm
go
on
online.
Call for tomorrow and Thursday to be a juror. Yes, I have to call tonight at 5 o'clock.
But again, the point is, it comes from the role of people who are registered voters.
Correct.
And we live at a time in which I'm not going to. At which there are accusations out there that there are active efforts to suppress voting, and you know what I'm talking about, in certain areas among certain people.
Gerrymandering.
Then that feeds off itself, does it not?
Yes. So if you don't have people of color or people who are open-minded to racial equity in the jury box, chances are a person of color who is a defendant is not going to be able to get a fair trial.
Okay. Mark Gonzi, I want to get you on your way. If you want to weigh in, a final thought on that, I also don't want this one to go by. I came across something. DNA testing in one case can cost up to $50,000. The article is saying that while genetic DNA tests like 23andMe are fairly affordable, the kinds of DNA tests used in criminal cases can be very costly, $50,000. But if it uncovers somebody's innocence, how do you guys make that? I mean, how do you afford that, Mark Gonzi?
Well, DNA testing in one of our cases, $50,000 would be super extreme. That would be a case where a lot of pieces of evidence have to be tested. I think that would be quite unusual. So, you know, like if it's a rape case and you're just testing the rape kit for the semen of the perpetrator, I mean, that might be $1,000 or $2,000. This is much more common that it's going to be way below that. I mean, I think the Clarence Elkins case was an exoneration out of Summit County where we had to test, you know, all these different fingernails and all these different items. I don't think it got up to 50,000, but, you know, so typically it's going to be a lot less than that. Sometimes the state lab, BCI, does the testing. And so that's free if it's done that way because, you know, that's their setup to do, and they just do DNA testing all day long. But sometimes the commercial labs, meaning the private labs out of state, will have more advanced testing. And so for that, you know, we have to raise money or get grants and things like that, but we've been able to do that in some cases.
You're down there in Cincinnati. That's Hamilton County. If I go into the Hamilton County Jail, there is such a place, I'm guessing?
There
okay.
is.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes,
okay. What is the racial makeup of the population going to be? Roundabout.
I don't know, but it's heavily black. I don't know the exact numbers.
Okay. And again, I'm reading now, this comes from the John D. Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Our goal is to support policies and practices that will safely, this is bold, safely reduce jail populations by 50% across all safety and justice challenge jurisdictions, of which Lucas County is one, has been funded twice, and eliminate racial inequities. I'm going to, on that note, Mark, ask you to give me action points, and I'm going to let you go. First steps to be taken to eliminate racial inequities. You started down the road. You said you could go a long ways. I won't let you go too long, but share some thoughts with me because we just had some really good ones up here in studio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated thing. So it's not just the judges and juries and things like that, but it's the laws we passed. I mean, look how we handled the crack epidemic, which was typically inner city black people, versus the heroin epidemic, which was typically rural white people. You know, there's sympathy and let's not use the criminal justice system. Let's get treatment versus in the 80s and 90s with crack, let's make mandatory minimums. And if you're caught with a tiny bit of it, throw you in jail for 20 years.
Hmm.
It's the laws we're passing and the penalties that you look at the legislative, aspects of that. Are racially based. They have a greater impact in the black community. It's where we're focusing and targeting our investigations. So, you know, David Harris is a scholar at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, but he used to be a professor at University of Toledo.
Absolutely.
And while he was at Toledo, he did all this great research showing that, you know, white people are committing these crimes just as often as black people. But it's racial profiling and other things that are leading to black people being arrested at a greater rate. So you can Google David Harris, University of Toledo, and find some of his scholarships. So, you know, it's complicated. It's all over the place. It's coming from multiple angles. You know, so it's something that hopefully that we can start looking at. I mean, we are seeing a movement recently about let's decrease incarceration. That's obviously a step in the right direction, because incarceration, not only is it racially biased, but it's costing us a fortune, and states have gone bankrupt because of mass incarceration and all these mandatory minimums. It's not even smart to be spending all this taxpayer money on locking up people that don't need to be locked up. Not only is it costing money, but then, you know, if we're not doing anything to help people get back on their feet, we're just creating people who are going to commit more crimes once they get out. So, you know, it's not just racial issues. It's being smart on crime rather than just acting like, you know, tough on crime with respect to everything. So it's a complicated thing, but I'm glad that we are seeing some people who want to, you know, I'm happy to hear that in Toledo and Lucas County that we're breaking down the silos and people are being reasonable and talking about these issues.
Well, and we appreciate the Ohio Innocence Project doing its work to free people again, did not do the crime. I don't want to dash anything here. I just came across new numbers, I do believe, incarceration rates, which across the country plummeted during the pandemic. And part of that was, let's get some nonviolent people out because prisons were such a hotbed for the whole COVID thing. But Ohio's prison population has begun creeping back up to pre-pandemic levels. So the work will continue. And we're glad you're on the front lines, and especially, like I say, there's a national number of some 35 people freed from death row, you know, in this nation's prisons who now have life and freedom. So, Mark Gonti, I want to thank you so very much. So much great information.
Thanks for having me on.
Keep up the good work, Mark Gonti, down there at the University of Cincinnati. Now, let's get it back here
in
studio.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark, very much.
See you soon.
Professor Gonti. You talk to Mark from time to time, don't you, Willie?
Yeah, we were just in New Orleans together. And in Cincinnati 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Yeah. So I always like to bring things, again, we started with two questions that were asked by our viewers. What are we doing to free people, innocent people, from jail? And I think we got some pretty good answers today. It's not foolproof. As he said so many times, where is the evidence? It's destroyed, it's gone, it's lost, or whatever. Or maybe there was never any collected in the first place. Willie?
Fabricated. Yep.
All right. So work to be done, but there is actually work being done to free innocent people.
Yes, it is.
And then the second question was asked by our viewers. They were viewers because it was a stream. They always ask the greatest questions. I used to think I was a good interviewer, and then I just went out, if you just shut up, Jerry, and listen to people, they will ask all the great questions. Just write them down and ask them. Because I was always the conduit for the people out there. The fact that we're dealing with what's being done on the reentry piece, and both of you are extremely involved with that. Give me a forward look on what we can do to continue down this forum. What are the biggest challenges we face in terms of rethinking jails and justice? That's the name of what we're doing here. Your thoughts?
I think that we have to be open to embracing individuals who are coming home or who've been involved in the criminal justice system. We have to understand that they, just like us, everybody, they're people. They're dealing with the same exact things everybody else is dealing with: family relationships, employment, needing to make money to support themselves, needing to find housing. Anything we can check off of our list, they can check off their list as well. So one thing that employers and landlords can be open to is providing a second chance for individuals to work and to house them. They can't make a living if they don't have employment. They need somewhere to live in order to be able to support themselves and to have a gainful employment, to have a successful family, and to move themselves forward. Those things are necessary. Those are all staples that we all need. So if landlords would be open to allowing returning citizens to live in their apartments or houses, that would be a huge help. If employers, which we saw during COVID, if employers were opening up, they were lessening their restrictions on who they would hire. They often found that those were some of the best workers. So if people would keep that same mindset, now that we're kind of post-COVID, keep that same mindset and understand they want to work, they will prove themselves time and time again, and they will make you proud and do be one of your best employers, do the best job that they can for you.
Yeah, by law, it's illegal for me to not hire you because, for example, you're a minority. That would be illegal, right?
Correct.
And the same thing with housing, right? But is there anything out there that says, I'm choosing not to hire her because, you know, she did spend time?
No, they can set their own policies. They can say, I'm not going to hire you I'm not going to hire someone who hasn't been out for at least 7 years. I'm not going to hire someone who, well, maybe I need 10 years, or maybe it's this type of crime that we're not going to look at. They can set their own policies.
You hear that?
Yes, I know this for a fact.
Or you had a gap in your employment for 4 years.
Can you explain this gap away? What is this gap? Why didn't you work for 4 or 5 years? How does someone explain that away without telling them where they honestly were? And then if you lie about it, they're going to eventually find out anyway, so it's a catch-22.
Okay. Willie, I want you to pick it up from somebody who has lived it. I mean, folks, we're talking about a conviction of murder.
Mm-hmm.
13 years in that one stretch of his life, mm-hmm. gone. I mean, he made use of his time, but gone from what we would have expected daily life and living.
A
lot of losses.
We're in the right direction. I can speak for the state of Ohio and especially Lucas County. Getting the right people in the right positions is a start. This win and losing between defense attorneys and prosecutors, it has to go. We need credibility. We need some integrity. We need education. The housing piece for those coming out of incarceration is huge. It is huge. It's a make or break. Mm. You get a young man or woman coming home and you put them in a place to stay. We're so willing to work. We're so willing to prove ourselves, given a second chance, but how can we? We're in survival mode, you know? So it's a lot of different things, but we're definitely headed in the right direction here. You know, we have a lot further to go, but we're going at a steady pace, a real steady pace in the right direction.
I thank you for sharing. One organization, one agency that was not involved and represented at our town hall meeting, and we're big enough to say, they let us know that they weren't there and they would have been there if they had been invited. We're going to make good on that.
Right.
We have a few. Was the Lucas County Prosecutor's Office. So thank you for sharing the news of the integrity unit, because I have to admit, I was bothered when I heard Mark Godsey point out, and it's a fact, we elect judges, we elect prosecutors, and sometimes going down the path of finding the truth runs afoul of public opinion out there. Mm-hmm. And yet I need those people's votes. So once again, here we are with politics.
Yeah, and shout out to Commissioner Pete Gerken, because he spearheaded that and got the meeting with Prosecutor Bates. And so,
okay, we'll keep posted on that. I want to thank Law Professor Mark Godsey, Ohio Innocence Project, joining us. Fascinating stuff and the work they are doing down there.
Absolutely.
Karen McConnell, president by title?
Yes.
Of the Reentry Coalition of Northwest Ohio, doing a fantastic job of finding ways to get people back productively into society while not seeing any uptick in recidivism. That's extraordinary. And also exonerated former inmate Willie Knighton. How did you refer to yourself earlier? What do you call yourself?
The Reentry Support Specialist.
Oh, that's pretty good. I like that. Willie Knighton joining us, sharing his experiences and insights on our criminal justice system. My name is Jerry Anderson. I want to thank Willie Knighton Jr. in our studio. Karen McConnell, good to see you. Thank you, folks, for listening. Appreciate it. Be well out there, and let's talk again. And we did. Our deep dive into the criminal justice system with the bright lights on local jails raised a host of audience questions about kids in crime. Is it out of control? Is a kid who starts down that path destined to a life on the wrong side of the law? I'll ask on our next The Anderson Hour, part of the local thread on WGTE Public Media. Thanks for being there. Let's talk again. Produced by WGTE Public Media and made possible by support from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation as part of the Safety and Justice Challenge, which seeks to reduce over-incarceration by changing the way America thinks about and uses jails.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.